Welcome to the UFO Files. I'm Jerry Pippin. And we are at the Tuscany, and that's in Las Vegas on Flamingo, just east of the Strip. And welcome to our program from the Crash Retrieval Conference. Nick Redfern is with us, and Nick, we keep crossing paths.
We do.
You're a busy man.
Yeah, I try and keep busy and, you know, do a lot of research, magazine articles, books, etc.
You spoke here on a thing called Project Moondust, and we'll talk about that here in just a second. I guess Ryan Wood and you're together collaborating on a book about this subject, huh?
Yeah, Moondust's an interesting story. The basic scenario of it is that, you know, if UFO crashes occur, are the recoveries just handled randomly by, you know, the nearest military unit, or is it kind of like a crash retrieval team that goes out? And so myself and Ryan are putting all this material together.
What did you find out?
Well, you know, there's quite a bit of documentation being released on Moondust, which does talk about the so-called quick reaction units responding to incidents that in some cases are, do sound like UFOs. One in Bolivia in 1978, where some documents have surfaced on this case, talks about the recovery and crash of a 15-foot diameter egg-shaped object in the Bolivian mountains. And this doesn't sound like a satellite or rocket debris or anything like that. It does sound far stranger. And we found some policy documents on Moondust which talk about how, I mean, they explicitly use the term UFO in terms of what they're looking to recover. And it talks about how the personnel on the projects were trained in quick reaction techniques, how to get in, to get out, secure crash sites, that sort of thing. So it does look like this is some sort of crash retrieval unit.
Now, you mentioned Bolivia. Are we talking about the U.S. government going into other countries and recovering this stuff?
Yeah, there's an interesting document from 1961 that actually states that Moondust personnel will be trained to go in and recover items, as they call them, of extreme intelligence and technological interest. And it actually states regardless of location. So they're quite clearly looking, you know, under cover of night or whatever, you know, parachute the guys in and secure the site, no matter if it's, you know, America, South America, you know,
wherever
if they can conceivably get in and get whatever's there and bring it back.
It's interesting that the United States seems to get cooperation from everybody on this issue. You would think somebody would say, hey, you can't come in here.
Well, you know, there have been rumors that, you know, people have said, I mean, for example, with the Bolivian case, there's no doubt that the Americans took a lot of interest in that and went out there. But the official story of the Bolivian government is, sorry, we didn't find anything. So in that case, it might well be that the Bolivians did withhold whatever it was they found, despite the fact that there were people from NASA and Moondust out there. Maybe they didn't actually get cooperation on that one.
Well, you know, you're an interesting fellow. You've written some books. For instance, the Roswell book, where you pretty much took the other issue that nothing really happened. What do you really feel? Are you still not about Roswell, but about all of this?
Well, I mean, you know, I think when it comes to UFOs, people want you in the believer camp or the skeptic camp.
Mm-hmm.
For me,
I'm trying to find out where you're camped.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't really camp anywhere. I think it's more from the perspective that I think it's important that, because, you know, I always say to people, the U in UFO still stands for unidentified. And I think it's the onus is on us to put all the information out for people to see. I think the only way we're going to resolve the UFO mystery is to look at all the evidence, not just the evidence that we want to hear about. And that's the only reason I put the Roswell book out, was purely and simply to say, hey, this is what other people are saying. Can we verify it, or is it disinformation? And that's the same with Moondust. I'm putting the book out, or the information out, to people to say, this is what we've uncovered, you know, and here it is. So, you know, for me, there's no doubt in my mind that there's a genuine UFO mystery. I think part of it is based around probably classified military aircraft, a small percentage. And I think there's a small percentage that also, when you get rid of the hoaxes and the misidentifications, there's a genuine UFO mystery where something is visiting us. I don't know if it's extraterrestrial, interdimensional, what it is, but there's something here.
So you're still open to the whole subject?
Oh, I'm convinced that there's a genuine... We have visitations from something, yeah.
But
I think there's several different strands. I don't think the UFO mystery will be solved by one thing. I think some cases will be shown to be classified weird military aircraft. Others will be genuine UFOs.
Yeah, where was moon dust based out of?
Well, it was based at Fort Belvoir in Virginia.
Virginia.
And it was housed there throughout its time from when it was set up in the mid-50s through to the 1980s.
So it was that early?
Oh, yeah, mid-50s to the 80s. And what happened after that was that it still exists in some form today, but it has a new classified name.
They renamed the name.
Yeah, and we don't know what
that
name is.
You don't have a clue?
No, they will not release that name.
Were they cooperative at all on moon dust?
Well, to an extent. I mean, there's probably about 900 pages of documents have now been released into the public domain on moon dust. Most of the reports fall into the category of recoveries of things like Soviet rocket material, satellites, because that was another role that moon dust had.
Right, we were like Keksberg, for instance.
Yeah.
There was a big rumor that it was a Soviet satellite. I don't know whatever really was decided.
Yeah. But some of the reports are more intriguing. As I said, like the Bolivian one, and there's some in the, there's one from the 1960s, 1965, where an object exploded over the Congo. And moon dust personnel got hold of some of the fragments.
Oh, Tarzan's territory.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow, what happened there?
Well, what happened was that the CIA have declassified a document that was forwarded to moon dust and that talks about the crash of this object that actually exploded in the sky. And that I don't think they recovered the whole thing. They got fragments of it. But they were sent back for analysis. And one or two documents on this case have surfaced, but unfortunately we don't have anything too substantial, and that's one of the problems in a lot of these cases, that we hear rumors and whistleblower testimony, but actually getting hold of the hard files is a bit difficult.
Do you have any hunch or educated guess about where some of this crash retrieval material might be?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Moondust files, they talk about how they liaise very closely with the foreign technology people at Wright-Patterson. So I think what it seems to be is that the Moondust people are based out of Fort Belvoir. They would be the guys who would go out and recover the material. They would then liaise and send it to the Foreign Technology Department people at Wright-Patterson. And so, you know, we hear these tales about...
Wright-Patterson was at least a major player
back
in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably still, don't know.
No, I'm sure to an extent that, maybe a lot of it's been transferred out now. I don't know. But certainly... In the 60s and 70s, Wright-Patterson was a big player in the moon story.
Did you get a hunch that there was a lot of back engineering going on this stuff?
Or
were most of the crashes not that complete? In other words, just debris?
Well, the documents talk about... they don't talk about back engineering, but they do talk about how we need to get hold of this material so we can examine it for, you know, our scientific advancements. So it was quite clear they're looking to determine how exotic technologies work, and we need to get our hands on them and see what we can do with them, which is kind of like leading towards back engineering.
Yeah, we hear all kinds of stories... Mm. Any evidence in the Project Moondust research that you did about anyone getting injured or hurt or killed?
Not really. I mean, there are some cases, where they've reported that some of the retrieval teams have died of weird illnesses or radiation exposure. And they kind of...
Did you see some evidence?
No, not in the files. But they do kind of sound like Moondust teams, mm-hmm. These quick reaction teams. Now, right. In certain cases, people said, some of the retrieval members died, but they didn't mention Moondust by name, but it sounds like a Moondust operation.
Now, you mentioned Fort Belvoir. That's an Army post. Was this an Air Force operation or an inter-service thing or what?
Yeah, I mean...
Or was it all civilians?
No, Moondust actually involved the Army, the Air Force, mm-hmm. the Defense Intelligence Agency, and with overseas cases, they would liaise with the State Department to try and get permission from other countries where there was a State Department office to go
in there. So there is evidence that we did at least notify the countries.
Cases when they didn't, but they did try where possible to have a diplomatic question, you know, can we come into your country and see what this is?
How did you get this material? Basically, freedom of information?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is just innocuous stuff, satellite materials. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every sort of 20, 30 pages, you'll find some interesting ones. And I do sometimes wonder if they just didn't, the declassifiers wondered if there wasn't really anything of interest there and just said, yeah, put it out, not realizing that there were a few nuggets.
Yeah, in other words, they didn't read it all either.
Yeah, they couldn't be bothered.
the latest clerks.
Yeah. Right? I think that happens occasionally, you know, these declassification
people. Well, yeah, that would be the eternal hope of every researcher, I imagine. Yeah. And I guess it does happen.
You find occasionally it does. I think, you know, you find a declassification person who overlooks something, and that opens a little door to something else.
I wonder if there's any ramifications on that.
There could be. I mean, maybe when they realize they've released something, unfortunately, that might then prompt them to shut down even further.
They probably wouldn't want to tell someone.
No.
If they could get out of it.
Yeah.
you know, this whole subject, you've been involved in this for, a couple of decades almost.
Yeah, I mean, I got interested. My father was in the British Royal Air Force. He worked on radar, and he was involved in tracking UFOs on a couple of occasions.
Oh, you actually saw some blips that couldn't identify?
Yeah, they tracked them. They sent planes up. Everybody was sworn to secrecy and told not to talk about it. And when my dad told me this, that's what really got me interested. And so that's what, you know, when you meet someone who, like your father, who's trained in radar, then you realize that there are weird things flying around. So.
And why do you think we have the situation of the cover-up to begin with? Is it because of safety issues?
Well, you know, I think maybe in the early years it was, we don't know what's going on, so we won't say anything.
Yeah, in the Cold War.
Yeah, and I think today it probably is related to the idea of trying to get new technologies that they don't want to fall into enemy hands. And so the best way to prevent the enemies finding out is not to tell anyone anything. So
just mum is the word.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you've got a book out about Bigfoot, is that right?
Yeah, I've got my other interest other than UFOs is cryptozoology, and I've got a new one called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, which is like a five-year trek around the U.S. and Puerto Rico looking for lake monsters, the Chupacabras, Bigfoot.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that when we come back. And if you you have anything else you'd like to add about UFOs, got anything breaking stories you can tell me?
I guess for the most part, I've just been sort of focusing on the moon dust stuff recently. Yeah. You know, trying to determine if these are the guys who, you know, we need to pursue further, which I think they are.
Nick Redfern is our guest, and we're going to talk about cryptozoology when we come back. This is Jerry Pippin. I'd like to take an opportunity here to talk to you about our websites. We've been adding programs and adding programs, and sometimes it's difficult to find what you're looking for. First of all, we have a search mechanism on each of our websites, and you can click, like if it's jerrypippin.com or if ipodshows.net, just search the websites, put in the name of what you're looking for, and it will come up. Check us out, won't you? Often. Nick Redfern, tell me a little bit about cryptozoology. Mm. I mean, I'm interested in that, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, cryptozoology is my other big interest, aside from
UFOs. And we're talking about weird, unexplainable things of nature. And many of them are, most of them are, can be attributed to, either freaks of nature or leftover evolution things.
Yeah, I think, you know, It broadly covers everything from like the Loch Ness Monster, sea serpents, Bigfoot, the Chupacabras. And I think some of these, at least, are probably creatures that have survived extinction, perhaps from the prehistoric era, particularly sea serpent-type reports and lake monsters and things like that.
Yeah, in your book, what can we expect to find there? You have them in sections, or you tell stories, or
I mean, there's different chapters and different ones. I've made two trips to Puerto Rico looking for the Chupacabras. I've spent about a month out there altogether.
Okay, we all hear all kinds of stories about those down in Puerto Rico. Yeah. Did you see one?
I didn't see one, no, but I spoke to a lot of people who did.
And I guess they can jump 30 feet or so?
Well, most of the people actually just reported seeing these things in the fields, killing animals, and described them as being like a monkey-like body with large bat-like wings and glowing eyes, sort of really weird-looking creatures. So.
Why do you? They seem to be more common. Maybe I'm wrong on this. If I am, you can correct me. But it seems to be more common in Central and South America. All of these stories.
Yeah, I mean, it began largely in Puerto Rico, and then you get reports in Florida, and it was almost as if it was moving, and then Mexico, and then down to Chile, Argentina, and places like that. So either it's moving or it's spreading. One of the two. So.
Well, what do you? Think that we're really talking about here?
I truthfully don't know.
Is it like the Spanish word bloodsuckers? Is that what they do?
Yeah, I mean, all the reports that I found on the island when I went there, you know, people described animals drained of blood, almost like a classic two puncture marks on the neck.
A vampire type.
Yeah, but the people over there were kind of in different opinions depending on who you spoke to. Some thought it was connected with the fact that there's a lot of UFO activity on the island. Some people were talking about weird genetic
experiments. Yeah,
in fact,
there's a story for several years was, hey, these are UFO pets.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a bit simplistic. But
yeah.
I'm not sure they're pets just taking them for a walk.
Yeah, right, and they got away.
Yeah, but I mean, no, a lot of people do think they're kind of some genetic experiment, either an alien one or a government one. Other people on the island saw them.
Any
like
evidence of government things doing?
Only rumors and stories.
Yeah.
But other people thought they were kind of like a paranormal creature, supernatural.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different theories depending on who you speak to.
Because nobody, as far as I know,
nobody's caught
has
one,
a
yeah.
corpse.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, you know, it causes a lot of superstition.
Same thing with Bigfoot.
Yeah.
What do you think, they bury their own or what?
Well, you know, I mean, again, it's one of these mysteries that, why don't we find a body or anything like that? And again, that makes some people think, are these paranormal? Are these supernatural and rather than just a flesh and blood ape?
Yeah, well, there have been a lot of reports of Bigfoot around UFO sightings,
too. Yeah, there's a lot. So, you know, I think some of these things are flesh and blood animals, like sea serpents, lake monsters. Others, I'm not so sure that they might sort of straddle two areas, you know, maybe semi-physical, semi-paranormal in some way. And I think that's why they avoid capture.
The sea monsters, of course, with the Loch Ness Monster and all the other things, is it basically, you know, that's been the thing of movies as well as Bigfoot and other creatures. Mm-hmm. But what about the Loch Ness? Is something there?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, Loch Ness is a very large body of water. It's 22 miles long, a mile wide, and at its deepest point.
And it's very deep, right?
At its deepest point, it's almost 1,000 feet deep. So it's huge. And so the idea that, you know, a colony of creatures could live there isn't that out of the ordinary. And if they breathe, they take oxygen from the water, they probably don't have to surface that often. So the chances of seeing something 15 foot long in a 22-mile body of water that breathes underwater like a fish, the chances of seeing it aren't very, good chances.
Right, it wouldn't be very good.
No, and I think also what a lot of people forget is that if this is a water-breathing animal, when they die, they just sink to the bottom. Their corpse won't come, you know, float to the top. It's going to sink to the bottom, and it's going to get eaten by the other creatures in the loch. So, you know, that's what nature
does.
Yeah, that's
the way it works.
Yeah, so, you know, again, the chances of finding a body after death aren't very high, really. So.
Now, do you have any examples of a man being impacted by one of these sea monsters? I mean, have they come on board a ship or something?
Not so much on board, but there are some old records I found in some of the British Royal Navy files that talk about how they saw these huge serpents and they came very close to the ship. And, you know, the crew were concerned that there was going to be a collision. There wasn't, but there are reports of, you know, this huge monstrous thing came within 20 feet of the ship.
Yeah, I have visions of it, part of it in the water, part of it out.
Yeah, that's right, like a serpent and the neck coming up and humps and things like that. Yeah.
But no reports that you found where somebody captured something that...
There are a few reports. The problem is, most of the reports where people captured something or it was washed up on the shore were like 100, 200 years ago. And we've got a few photographs of weird things from 100 years ago, 50 years ago. But unfortunately, the people, you know, just local villagers, didn't bother trying to preserve the evidence, and it just rotted away. And we just don't really know what they were. That's the problem. So.
Now, what's the most unusual animal you found in cryptozoology research, and maybe you write about in your book?
I think one of the strangest is probably people who said they've seen so-called real-life werewolves. you get a lot of people who say they see what look like werewolf-type creatures, like giant man-like creatures with wolf-like faces.
Does that happen basically in this country or in Eastern Europe?
Or? Eastern Europe, England, America, South America, you get a lot of these reports, and they become, some people call them werewolves, other people call them dogmen. They get different names, you know, depending on the folklore of the area that exists. So they're strange ones.
Yeah, now most of the werewolf stories, literally the werewolf, changes from a man.
Yeah, now most of the reports aren't like that. They're just of like a very large wolf-like creature. But some people have said it seems to be able to walk on 4 feet and 2 feet, like a bear, but for longer periods. And that's not necessarily out of the ordinary. There were, up to probably about 500,000 years ago, there were some very, very large types of wolves that existed in the United States. I mean, almost like the size of a tiger or a lion. Huge predatorial wolves, and they became extinct. But some people wonder if maybe in some of the bigger forests they didn't become extinct, and perhaps these could be the source of some of these legends.
So this is really a worldwide phenomenon. Everything that we're talking about here today, including the UFO thing, but... Bigfoot, let's get back to that. A lot of people are interested in Bigfoot. Any reports of Bigfoot doing any damage to humans?
For the most part. For the most part, it seems to be like with gorillas. You know, they put on a show of force. You know, if you're faced with a Congo mountain gorilla, they'll charge you for the most part, but they won't attack. They'll back off at the last minute and beat their chests. But it's a show of force. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Bigfoot reports, you hear them throwing rocks at people and screaming, and it's almost as if it's an intimidation rather than a physical attack. So
what? How do you attribute to that? I guess they're not predators from the sense of grabbing humans and eating them.
No, I mean, most of the...
They may be vegetarians.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think, you know, if you talk about a creature that's 7 feet tall, weighing 500 pounds, it's got to take in a lot of food. And if they were killing deer or animals in the woods all the time, I think we would see a lot more evidence of broken carcasses and things. I think the likelihood is that they probably are vegetarian, or maybe they just, you know, eat whatever they can find.
And maybe they eat it all.
Eat it all. Just don't leave any traces, maybe. I don't know. I guess if you're in the wild, you know, you've got to take what's there.
So you don't really think of the Bigfoot as being a danger to man, or we just don't
I would think only in the sense if it was cornered, you know.
Yeah, and it would be defensive.
I mean, if you corner an 8-foot-tall ape, it's going to, you're going to come off worse.
If it comes down to that.
Yeah, we're not going to win.
have you talked to anybody who claims they've ever tracked down a Bigfoot and tranquilized it or found it when it was dead?
No, I mean, there are historical reports where there's a famous story, a guy named Albert Ostman, who said he was actually carried off by one of these things into what was like a little valley where these creatures supposedly lived,
and
he escaped.
Was this?
This was in Washington State, a long time ago, in the 20s.
Bigfoot country, right?
Yeah.
But there it's actually a misnomer, because Bigfoot seems to be in Pennsylvania and Arkansas and wherever.
Texas, even in some of the big thicket woods of Texas, which is sort of a few hours from where I live, they get reports even there. It seems anywhere there's large forest land, swamps, you get legends of these sorts of things out there. You know, the skunk ape in Florida and things like that. So
you know, we're going to have to wrap this up here in a minute, but you know, every time I talk to you, I get infatuated with the whole idea of cryptozoology. Even though most people think of you as a UFO man, you do other things too. We talked the last time about you writing some things about Hollywood celebrities.
Yeah, I do a lot of books on different subjects. I suppose to people in the UFO subject, I'm known for those. But I like to do cryptozoology, and as you mentioned, I had a book earlier this year called Celebrity Secrets, which is a study of the way in which the FBI used to watch famous Hollywood stars like Marilyn Monroe.
In Roswell, we talked about that, because they can hear that show on our website. I guess we decided in that conversation, Nick, and if I got it wrong, tell me, but it seems the FBI would rather watch Frank Sinatra or Marilyn Monroe than Joe Blow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they kept anybody who was famous in the Hollywood world, and it was mixing with people like the Kennedys and, you know, the Mafia. They watched all those sorts of people, and they watched their friends and watched their friends.
When, in your Celebrity Secrets, did you discuss the Robert Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe murder mystery?
I did, yeah.
And what do you draw from that?
Well, I think she was either murdered or was allowed to die. You know, they found her and it was, well, let her die, and then there's no questions going to be brought up again. I think it was something along those lines.
Yeah. Anything else that you'd like to bring to our audience before you go to your next? I mean, you're all over the place, but you are close to me. I'm in Oklahoma. You're in Dallas.
Yeah, not far away. Yeah.
Anything else that you've run across here at this conference?
Well, I think for me the most interesting thing about the conference is that, you know, a lot of the cases we're talking about, we are beginning to get documents. People are speaking on the record. It's not just anonymous sources where we're not able to track them down. And I think that's good that there's teams of people around the world now actively looking into these cases and getting things done. So
it seems that, of course, a lot of retired people from not only our government, but France and England and Russia are coming forward now, disclosure.
I think that's the important thing. When you've got people, you know, of rank and credibility, I mean, a lot of credible witnesses that just don't have, you know, the ranking or whatever, and they've got great cases. But when you talk about, you know, colonels and people in the military coming forward and high-ranking people, that gets the media's attention, and I think that opens a few doors for us as well.
Is there a penalty for talking about this stuff? I guess there is. Well, most of them are sworn to secrecy.
Well, there is, but then again, if you speak out and you're punished, then that proves that you're speaking truthfully. So I think the best thing...
It's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah, I think when people do speak out, the government just hopes the controversy will go away.
I'm going to use that as an angle when I talk to some of these experiencers.
Yeah.
Say, hey, they're not going to do anything to you.
No, they won't for the most part, because then that just proves what you're saying is real. So.
Nick Redfern, tell us the name of that book on cryptozoology again.
That's called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, and it just recently published last month.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed seeing you again.
Thanks, Jerry. Thank you.
Okay.